Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is the future of the Internet. With me to discuss how the United States should adapt to a changing cyberspace landscape are Jamie Misick and Adam Siegel. Jamie is CEO of Global Strategic Insights, a strategic international consulting firm. Before entering the private sector, Jamie spent more than two decades at the Central Intelligence Agency, eventually becoming Deputy Director for Intelligence, the agency's most senior analytic post. Adam is the Ira A. Lippman Chair in Emerging Technologies and National Security and Director of the Digital and Cyberspace Policy Program at CFR. He is most recently the author of The Hacked World Order, How Nations Fight, Trade, Maneuver, and Manipulate in the Digital Age. Jamie is the co-chair and Adam is the project director of the CFR-sponsored Independent Task Force on Cybersecurity. The task force recently released a report titled Confronting Reality in Cyberspace, Foreign Policy for a Fragmented Internet is available on CFR.org. Jamie and Adam, thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
Good to hear.
Jamie, I'd like to begin with you. As I mentioned, the report's title is Confronting Reality in Cyberspace. What is the reality that the United States needs to confront in cyberspace?
Well, thank you. The reality is that the era of the global open internet is over, and that the United States needs to recognize that and change its approach accordingly. One of the first things we would want to recognize is that the United States does not control fragmentation. There are governments out there that want to close their societies, wall off their populations' access to the internet. We won't control that. Our allies won't control that. So we have to accept that the internet is fragmented, and we need to do more to recognize that to keep pace with this changing reality.
Okay, and I want to bring you in here. We're talking a lot about fragmentation. It's a big topic when we talk about cyberspace. Two questions for you. One, what do we actually mean by fragmentation? And number two, why should we care about fragmentation?
So there are different ways of fragmenting. The archetypal case is China with the Great Firewall, which keeps certain types of content out, prevents Chinese citizens from using U.S. services, keeps U.S. social media companies out of the domestic market. And then with a new set of regulations, cybersecurity law, the data security law, putting increasing demands on foreign companies who do business in China to keep data on Chinese citizens local. And so we see those trends are no longer just contained to China. They're actually spreading quite widely. And lots of U.S. friends and allies have economic and national security law enforcement reasons to try to keep data local. And so that the idea that the data, as Jamie said at the beginning, is going to flow freely across national borders is really not the case any longer for specific types and certain types of data. I think the U.S. is concerned about it primarily for two reasons. One is, as you know, Jamie mentioned at the beginning, when the internet first came, the U.S. adopted this idea that the free and open internet was going to be good for democracies and bad for authoritarian states. And so we have adopted this idea that the open internet is good for democracies and pushes it the same way that U.S. foreign policy does on values and human rights.
Wasn't it more than that, Adam? It seems to me back in the day when the internet was first taking off, not only did we think that the internet would be good for democracy, we also believe that the internet couldn't be controlled. I remember in March of 2000, President Bill Clinton dismissed Chinese efforts to try to control the internet and control free speech by saying it was like nailing Jell-O to a wall. Well, it appears the Chinese have figured out how to nail Jell-O to the wall.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think we thought it would be good for us and bad for our adversaries, right? And that they would be on the wrong side of history. And so there was also a kind of strategic push for that. And also it was an economic one. There was U.S. companies that were globalizing the internet and taking advantage of those trends. And as you said, you know, turns out the Chinese are really good at nailing Jell-O to the wall. Other countries have been learning from that. And other countries have also questioned why do all the economic benefits of openness flow to U.S. companies and to the U.S. economy. So we're seeing a lot of pushback on for all of those reasons. And, you know, right now, most of the fragmentation is on content, you know, what you can see and who can see it. It's increasingly on data. And it may, as the U.S. and China compete over the next generation of technology standards, it may in the future be on the actual interoperability of the technology.
So, Jimmy, maybe you want to jump in here, but I'm curious, why should Americans care if the Chinese can't see the same things we do? I mean, why should the person in Toledo or Tacoma be worried about that? But I think there's also a question here of why would things like data localization be bad? I suspect if I walked around most American cities and said, should American data be here in the United States? They would say, yeah, USA, USA, USA. So why can't the Chinese feel the same way the Egyptians, the Laotians, and the Brazilians and the rest?
Well, I think it is interesting that, you know, our report, our task force was trying to focus on the international aspect, less on the domestic. And going back to the points that Adam was making on the fragmentation, I think the goal of having a free and open internet was the right goal. You know, we don't want to walk away from that. The point we are trying to make is that the fragmentation has happened. We need to confront that reality. We need to change our approach. So when it comes to the future, things like digital trade agreements will become the basis of economic strength moving forward. We, the U.S. government, have to play an active role in formulating those agreements, not standing back and letting them happen to us. And I think that's where these rules on fragmentation truly affect Americans in Tacoma or wherever they may be.
Okay, let's talk just a bit about that, because digital trade agreements are a hot topic. But right now in the United States, we seem to be allergic to anything that is related to doing trade or a trade agreement. So what exactly would a digital trade agreement do? I mean, I think people understand about the movement of cars or grain or clothes. What does a digital trade agreement do?
Well, I think, you know, that touches to the early point about why Americans should care, right? And the reason why Amazon Cloud and Microsoft Azure and the Googles and the others become so successful is that they, you know, build these infrastructure that supports it at a global level, and you don't have to recreate everywhere you go. So if every country in the world said you have to store our data locally, then you have to build, you know, 193, whatever it is, data centers, incredibly expensive, it no longer scales, it no longer makes any economic sense. That said, as you said, there are legitimate reasons to keep some data local. And what the digital trade agreements do are decide what type of data do we all agree can be kept local, which type of data we all say, you know what, this can flow freely, there's no problem with it, or if we allow it to flow freely, what can happen to that data in another country? And so that's been a problem with the United States and Europe. We, for a while, had an agreement that said, oh, European data can come to the United States, no problem. But then because of the Snowden revelations and disclosures about some types of U.S. intelligence gathering, the European Court of Justice ruled that no European data was not being protected adequately. That agreement was then overthrown. And then the president just announced a new agreement that said we now have some new measures in place that protect European data. So basically, I think there's a reason to be more optimistic about digital trade agreements than we are about traditional trade agreements, because they, quite honestly, they require much less giving and taking from the countries, as opposed to we've all agreed on the standards about how the data should be treated.
I should note that the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which had been an American initiative, was going to set sort of the gold standard for digital trade agreements. President Trump pulled out of it. But the Trump administration actually took a number of the elements about digital trade from TPP and plopped them into the revised NAFTA agreement. And it's now considered, I think, to be a gold standard, at least for those three countries. I want to come back to this issue of trade and how to think about cooperation between the United States and Europe. But Jimmy, I want to talk about another finding in the task force report, which is that the internet has become much more dangerous. It's not just that it's less open, more fragmented, it is more dangerous. How so?
In my view, there's no question that cybercrime, which has escalated dramatically in the last few years, has become a national security interest. When it attacks hospitals, our infrastructure, and when it goes as far as influence operations inside our own countries that undermine public confidence in our institutions, then I think we have to treat it as a very serious issue and hence a very dangerous one. One of the recommendations we make in the report is that working with a coalition of allies, we should consider developing an international cyber criminal center to share information across countries. To date, what we have tried to do to thwart criminal activity with indictments or sanctions hasn't been effective enough. We haven't found the right tools to put together to really address that issue the way it needs to be addressed.
So speaking about cybercrime, one of the interesting things that the report flags are the links that exist between state actors. I'm thinking primarily China, Russia, I think also Iran, North Korea, and criminal gangs. In essence, they are sort of third-party actors for state governments. How do you deal with that, Adam?
Yeah, I think that's been one of the great challenges for the U.S. in this space as well. The U.S., our cyber capabilities are tightly controlled in the military and in the NSA. As far as we can tell, you know, we have a lot of legal and other discussions about when the U.S. can and conduct offensive operations. And the Russians and North Koreans and Iranians in particular use these proxy actors, which gives them a level of deniability because the U.S.'s attribution capabilities have significantly improved over the years and makes it much harder for the United States to respond and sanction or punish the right individuals, right? You want to impose costs on the people conducting the actions to try and change their calculus, but if the people that are conducting the actions are two or three people removed from the people that are ordering it, it makes it harder to design those sanctions. And so the U.S., I think, has had a very difficult time finding the pressure points for those types of attacks. You know, one of the points that the report makes is that, you know, the vast majority of cyber operations are espionage, right? So it's the theft of data.
Can we think espionage is okay? That's the official position of the U.S. government. That's what governments do to each other, correct?
Yes. Essentially, the U.S. has said all states are going to conduct cyber operations for intelligence perspective. That is going to happen. We, you know, our responsibility is to defend against it and disrupt it the best we can, but there's going to be no international agreements about it. Theft of intellectual property and business secrets, we say, should be off limits, right?
That's it. So I can spy on you if I want to figure out whether you're going to invade another country, but I'm not supposed to spy on you so I can take intellectual property, plans for that new weapon system so I can give it to my local companies, or take plans for that new semiconductor and give it to a local company. We say that's illegitimate. Yeah. The Chinese don't seem to feel the same way.
Yeah, well, weapon system is hard, right? Because that's defensive purposes. But I mean, the way that President Obama used to say it was, you can break into my iPhone to listen to what I'm saying to my cabinet. You can't break into Apple and take the information and give it to Huawei. But the Chinese, for a moment, seem to have agreed. So the U.S. mounted a very public campaign against China, naming and shaming, calling them out. We indicted PLA hackers from the People's Liberation Army.
Well, let me ask you a question then. Is there a distinction between cyber criminals and patriotic hackers?
The U.S. and the liberal democracies say they are often the same, right? And states should not rely on these proxies, but the other countries often rely on them. And go off on a further tangent, we're in this weird situation now where the Ukrainians are mobilizing patriotic and outside hackers to go after Russia, which from a, you know, perspective of the U.S. supporting Ukraine's IT infrastructure and its war effort doesn't seem like a terrible idea. But from the U.S.'s efforts to shape global norms is not.
We're legitimizing a behavior we say is illegitimate.
Yes. I think generally we have said this shouldn't be happening, but we don't say it very often and very loudly.
Jamie, I want to come to the report's third main finding, which is that the United States has failed to impose costs. Some of Adam's comments have alluded to that. Talk to me a little bit about what that means in a practical sense.
Well, I think that means it. We continue to see these attacks and that they are not thwarted to the extent we want to stop them. One of the things that the task force report talks about is whether or not we can lead by example in a couple of key areas. Can we, the U.S., say that we will not do certain things? No tampering with election infrastructures, no attacks on financial institutions, hospitals off limits. If we could get agreement from a coalition of countries to those kinds of norms, we can maybe lead by example, put some things off limits, nuclear command and control being another key element of that. Now, we are not under any illusions that our adversaries are going to sign up to agree to this, but that could be a helpful step for a majority of countries.
Well, let me jar you up more on this, because I can imagine some people listening to this conversation, wait a second, the United States is arguing that governments shouldn't snoop in or act in other countries' computer networks. But wait a second, the United States started this. As the task force report noted, the United States government launched Olympic Games, which is an effort to disrupt centrifuges being operated by Iran. So in some sense, the United States has legitimated the behavior it says we shouldn't do. How would you respond to that?
So I think the answer is when Jamie was discussing the kind of self-restraint that the U.S. would adopt, it's part of a larger shift in U.S. cyber strategy. So one thing we know that has happened, started under the Trump administration, has continued under President Biden, is that the U.S. has adopted a more forward-leaning, what they call defend forward, so trying to disrupt the attackers before they get to the United States.
Is this persistent engagement?
Persistent engagement, defend forward. So that is happening. And so part of the reason why the self-restraint is important is you want to signal to your potential adversaries what type of systems you're going to be on and disrupting. But we also say we have to have some more transparency about what we're doing and why we're doing it. And so I think one of the critiques you can make about U.S. operations in particular, you know, as you mentioned, Olympic Games or the Stuxnet attacks on the Iranian centrifuges, was that the U.S. probably had a legal justification in mind when they conducted those attacks. And so it probably would have been better that, you know, after the attacks became public, that the U.S. said, you know, under these conditions, these types of attacks are justified, right? You can imagine what legitimate uses of cyber operations there were. So in some ways, I would think that it was a missed opportunity for the U.S. to help define those norms, because we do have very few instances of operations that cross the threshold and cause physical destruction or disruption.
Let me ask this question as a way of follow-up. One of the things that people expected once Russia invaded Ukraine was for the Russians to launch major cyber attacks. They seem not to have. Is this because the Russians don't judge cyber attacks to be useful? Is it because U.S. efforts at persistent engagement have discovered the Russians? In essence, we've deterred them. Something else?
So I think there's a big debate going on right now about how useful the cyber has been in this conflict. And Foreign Affairs, in fact, published two pieces saying the exact opposite. One saying, as you said, it doesn't seem to have played the role that we expected it. The other saying, no, look, for example, on the attack on Viasat, which was a satellite broadband provider, which did, in fact, affect the Ukrainian communications. I think there's probably several explanations. One is, you know, the Russians seem to have thought that the war was going to go very quickly, right? And they would essentially capture Kiev, decapitate the leadership, put in a new leadership. And so they probably wanted communications infrastructure to remain in place so they can continue messaging and signaling. So the speed of the operation probably means that they, in fact, weren't ready to take down a lot of the systems because you do need to have persistence and a lot of planning. I think defense did help, right? The U.S. and NATO and the EU all sent teams forward in the months in advance, helping to protect and defend. So I think there was that. I think also the Russians, you know, we think that the Ukraine is winning the information war, which they are, I think, in the context of messaging to U.S. and Western Europe. But I think if you look at Russian messaging to developing economies, Africa, those places, it's not clear to me that we're winning that information war. And then those countries have been more supportive of Russia's position than I think we would have hoped.
And clearly, Russia is winning the information war in Russia. This gets back to your point at the beginning about the fragmented internet. They're able to control what information people access. Indeed, other countries sort of following the Chinese model to develop ways, in some sense, disconnect their countries from the internet for at least some periods of time. And so that the internal narratives get shaped differently.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the U.S. has struggled between, you know, some tech companies pulling out of the Russian market, others saying, no, we're providing services to Russian citizens so they can get some more information. And so that, you know, is an important point, kind of thinking about how should the U.S. signal to companies what their role should be in this space.
And I agree with what Adam just said in terms of what's going on in Ukraine. One of the key things that we've tried to distinguish in the task force report is the difference between cyber and information ops. And information operations, the kinds of things that you were just talking about, you know, the information being shown on Russian media, the messages being sent to the developing world from Russia, those are information operations trying to influence. The cyber piece of it, you know, I think we have seen a number of cyber attempts or attacks vis-a-vis Ukraine, that a lot of U.S. Companies and the government support, allied support, has been helpful in trying to limit, contain, and thwart, doesn't mean it will be off the table for the duration of the war.
I take that point, but now I want to really sort of focus on recommendations for the U.S. government. And Adam's point, Jamie, about how the United States work with NATO allies to help the Ukrainians deal with any potential Russian cyber attacks sort of leads into what I take to be one of the main recommendations of the report, which is that the United States should build a coalition of trusted partners. Tell me what you mean by that and how it would operate.
What the task force report focuses on is building a group of like-minded partners who agree to a certain set of operating principles where data could be trusted. So trade data flows would be efficient and trustworthy, that those countries may be democracies, they may be less than democracies, but we should not limit it to a values-based approach. It should be a willingness to sign on and be on board approach.
So we're not going to say only democracies are part of the coalition. The argument is if you accept the rule of law in this area, then we're happy to work with you.
Yeah, I think we want to shift away from the sense that we're going to judge which countries are democracies or not. But we can judge, oh, do you have some domestic provisions in place for how government how data is turned over? Do we agree on those norms, those kind of issues? And I think, you know, the Biden administration released this Declaration for the Future of the Internet in April, which essentially is a kind of re-embracing of this view of global, open, and interoperable. There had been early discussions that it was going to be a democratic alliance on, they decided to drop that. But from our perspective, you know, the fact that some big players, India and others, didn't sign onto the declaration is a real issue. Now, again, we don't want to give India a free card for the crackdown on the internet, the shutdowns.
India actually is a country that has quite frequently shut down the internet.
Yeah, so it leads the world on internet shutdowns. And, you know, just this month, we have this case of a Muslim reporter being prosecuted for his tweets, you know, supposedly offending other religions. And in, you know, one of the most kind of ironical things, Freedom House tweeted that internet freedom declined in India and they were forced to take it down. So we don't want to give India a complete get out of jail card on those issues. And as Jamie said, those are things we still want to push back on. But there's still lots of things we want to work on with India, and calling them undemocratic in that context of on data flows and other things is not particularly helpful.
Jamie, as you think about building this trusted coalition, how do you deal with the issue that our most trusted allies, our closest allies, the Europeans, have a different view on a number of these critical issues about privacy than we have? And Adam mentioned earlier, this has been sort of a thorn in U.S. European cooperation on some of these issues. Can we surmount that division?
Well, that certainly is one of our recommendations, that we have to recognize that in some areas, the Europeans have led on protecting personal data and privacy. The United States, frankly, has taken a back seat to some of the international efforts to regulate behavior on the internet, and we wind up being the recipient of decisions made elsewhere. Our recommendation is for the United States to get back to leading and influencing where those international forums take these types of issues. So whether or not it's the exact adoption of something that's already in place or a modification of that, but that is where we need to go, working with allies on these issues to find common ground to advance this, because data security, data privacy, digital trade agreements is going to be the basis of a lot of geopolitical power in the future, and we cannot just be a passive recipient of that.
Are you optimistic, Adam, that you can bridge differences across the Atlantic?
I think there's a reason to be more optimistic than normal in this space. I mean, right now, what is happening is that in the U.S., the states are leading. So we have 7 or 8 states now have adopted data privacy laws, and California being the big one. The companies themselves want a national data protection law because—
Well, I imagine that's a lot better than having 50 different data laws you have to follow.
Exactly. They don't want to have 50, and they also want to have a pretty big hand in shaping them, so they're not as oppressive as they would be. But I think there is a growing kind of bipartisan support on actually getting those policies in place. Now, my pessimism has to do about how politicized the whole tech regulation space is now, with the Democrats and Republicans wanting to accomplish other things at the same time about content moderation and things like that. But I do think we are going to make more progress on data than I would have.
I have to ask you then, can you give me a short tutorial on what these divisions are? Because all I know is when I watch MSNBC in the morning or CNN or other shows on my cable channel, I am flooded with advertisements which are telling me that Congress is about to do something totally un-American to my internet. And I don't know who's sponsoring these ads or what the actual underlying political divisions are.
So essentially, the bill, there are several bills. They do several things, but one is the companies could no longer self-preferencing. So Google could no longer, you know, push Yelp findings down and only show you the Google reviews at the top. They'll also, for example, open the Apple Store, right? So that more apps can be in Apple and also allow you to download other apps from outside of the Apple Store. There's antitrust regulation. So are the companies in the same business or are they expanding and other things? And then there's a lot of focus on content moderation, right? What are the companies allowed to take down to protect users and also to prevent misinformation or disinformation? Now, depending upon which side you're coming from, it's either, you know, violates the First Amendment, it's government's big hand in the market, it's creating a cybersecurity threat because Apple does a really good job of keeping out bad apps, forcing them to share data opens other insights. So across the kind of spectrum, there's a whole range of arguments about why it's bad and why it's good.
But this, Jamie, gets us to one of the red flags you raise at the end of the report, which is the inability of the United States to actually get its house in order. Walk me through that.
Well, I think it goes back in part to what I was saying earlier, that for the last several years, kind of taken a back seat and let other countries, the Chinese in particular, have been very effective in these international organizations, getting their people in to help set those standards. One of the areas that I actually have some optimism on is that tech security, digital security, cybersecurity seems to be one of those areas where there is bipartisan support. A bipartisan recognition that we have to do more. So that gives me some optimism there. One of the key things that we have to keep an eye on is pace. And we need to accelerate the pace here because we are going to fall behind if we don't get some of these policies and recommendations in the report moving forward. Now, I think there is a lot of work going on in the current administration and on the Hill that is positive, but keeping that focus is going to be really important over the next 2 or 3 years. One of the issues that we have to work on, and this report is not focused on that, is the public-private partnerships that are required here and the talent expertise getting into government that we need to have there. So while these, you know, green shoots, if you will, are promising, they really need to be nurtured because right now we are not at a pace where we are going to be leaders in this space, and we really, truly need to be.
Well, I have to ask you, Adam, given that Jamie just flagged the issue of pace, it's not only American pace that matters, it's the pace of others. China clearly is a pace setter or trend setter in these areas. Should we be worried that China is lapping the field, or is it the case that President Xi and his effort to sort of shut down the internet is basically killing the goose that laid the golden egg?
So I think it's a little of both. I think, you know, both the Chinese pace and rolling out the set of regulations over the last 5 years, and the Europeans keep, you know, we had just this last week, the Digital Service Act and the Digital Market Act both be pushed forward. So I think there is, as Jamie said, a real issue that the U.S. has been talking about this legislation for a long time, and it's not clear we're that much closer to getting it there. Now, the kind of uncertainty about the effects of the regulation, I think, is to some advantage for us. You know, the Chinese definitely seem to have been willing to impose significant costs on their tech firms, you know, trillions of dollars wiped off the books for, you know, Alibaba and Tencent and others. And there's been a long, you know, kind of standing critique about the Europeans is that they keep innovating on the regulation side is because they have no companies to that are actually innovating. And so that's the way that they project for it. And the U.S., you know, the reason why our tech industry was and continues to be so innovative is that we have had such a light hand on it. But I do think we're entering, and the task force knows, we're entering a new stage of innovation. We have, you know, artificial intelligence and quantum and Web 3.0, whatever that might mean.
I don't know what any of those three things mean, and I'm not going to ask you to explain it to me.
Coming forward, and you know, is that going to work again, right? The first time, you know, the hands-off approach worked probably because there was nobody else out there, right? And this time, I don't think we're so confident that the hands-off approach is going to be as effective.
Well, we're certainly seeing efforts to drop legislation that would have the government more involved in trying to subsidize indirect, we used to call it industrial policy back in the day. Do you think that's the answer?
I think it depends what type of sector we're talking about. I think, for example, around the chip industry, yes, the government probably does need it to lend a hand. If you look at the studies for, you know, how Taiwan, Singapore, Israel, South Korea all built the chip industry, it required massive amounts of government subsidies just because the capital expenditures in building a new semiconductor equipment plant are so important. And we, you know, semiconductors are the enabling foundation of all of the other technologies that we use. So I do think there is probably a strong argument to be made on the government needs to have a stronger hand. And we have bipartisan support for the CHIPS Act. It just has not been passed yet.
That gets back to your observation about the need to get your house in order.
Yes.
You can't simply talk. You have to do.
Yeah.
Jimmy, I want to close with you because you spend a lot of time watching things in Washington, thinking about these issues. Are you optimistic that we can maintain the pace or raise our pace to do what we need to do?
I think we need to raise our pace, and I am optimistic. I see a lot of good work in embryonic stages, but nonetheless, positive direction. I also think that there's a geopolitical component to this that has helped accelerate the pace. Russia's invasion of Ukraine brought countries who might have been trying to sit on a fence beginning to edge more towards, this is not what we want. You know, we want to join in something like this trusted coalition of countries we've talked about. And I think that Chinese behavior in some of these areas, exporting to other countries how to close down your internet, has caused, again, countries that were maybe trying to sit on the fence to say, you know what, we do need to think about joining together in a common trusted environment. So put me down as an optimist, but I understand the effort that needs to go into this to keep that pace moving forward.
On that optimistic note, I'm going to close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guests have been Jamie Misick, CEO of Global Strategic Insights, and Adam Siegel, the Ira A. Lippman Chair in Emerging Technologies and National Security and Director of the Digital in Cyberspace Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. You can read the CFR Task Force report, Confronting Reality in Cyberspace, Foreign Policy for a Fragmented Internet, on CFR.org. Jamie and Adam, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen, and leave us a review. We love to get feedback. You can find the books and articles mentioned in this episode, as well as a transcript of our conversation, on the podcast page for the President's Inbox on CFR.org. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Rafaela Siewert with senior podcast producer Gabrielle Sierra. Brian Mendivas was our recording engineer. Special thanks to Dr. Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.